There is a content warning for this episode as it discusses drug use and attempted suicide. Please consider this before you continue listening, and if you need help or support, please contact Lifeline on 131114. Welcome to Inspirational Tales. When my guests on this podcast experience the most challenging times of their lives, they use these hardships to learn, grow, and better themselves, and as a result, they are now thriving in life. Their stories are ones of resilience, strength, and overcoming adversity. So sit back and join me as we celebrate them turning their challenges into triumphs. My guest on this episode is Matt Caruana. In 2016, at the age of 16, and after struggling with mental health issues since he was 12, Matt attempted to take his own life by jumping off a 35-meter-high building. Luckily, he survived the fall, but when he woke up in hospital, he was confronted with the reality that he now had spinal cord and brain injuries, which he had to learn to navigate on top of his mental health issues. Now, at 22 years old, Matt has such a powerful story to tell. As you will hear in this interview, he has come a long way since his teenage years. In the years that followed his suicide attempt, he learnt to connect with those around him, he found purpose in his life, and he no longer suffers from mental health issues. Not only that, but he is now a motivational speaker and mental fitness facilitator who uses his experiences to help and inspire others and raise awareness for mental health. I know that this is quite a heavy topic, and I also know that every single one of you listening will get something out of hearing this episode, whether it be from Matt's story or from his advice for dealing with mental health issues. So make sure you listen to the end so that you don't miss out on anything. Hi, Matt. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. How are you?
I'm good, thanks, Jess. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. So today we're going to speak about mental health and your story and your mental health journey. And I feel like this is a topic that is very prevalent at the moment. It's obviously always important to speak about mental health, I think, but obviously with COVID and everything going on over the past couple of years and still now, I feel like it's become even more prevalent in the community and something that we really need to speak about. And your story, I think, having been through and come out the other end yourself of mental health issues, really, I think, brings hope to people in that just because you're going through something doesn't mean that it's going to be like that forever. And I mean, you're proof that is the case. So thank you for joining me today.
It's honestly a privilege.
I always like to start off my interviews back at the very beginning. So if you could take us back to your early childhood, do you remember a time when you didn't have mental health issues and what was your life like back then?
You know, my life growing up in a way was like sunshine, lollipops, rainbows. Like it was actually kind of like from the outside, it looked perfect, right? Growing up in school, I, you know, got good grades. I did well at sports. I, you know, was a pretty social guy, like pretty outspoken, all that stuff. Come high school, I was, you know, decently popular as well. And, you know, from the outside, things looked perfect. It really did. I suppose, personally, within me, though, I felt disconnected to my parents, both of them. And that led me, I suppose, down a rabbit hole. I mean, you just get used to seeing these things and just feeling these things. It just becomes normal. So I didn't really think anything of it. But yeah, from the outside, picture perfect.
It's often the case, isn't it, though? From the outside, you don't always know what someone's going through from looking at them.
Yeah.
I think you've said previously when you were around 12 years old that you started to question your life and question things for yourself. Can you take us through that? And when your mental health struggles began?
Yeah, I was 12, like you said, and this was now like midway year seven. You know, I would for some reason always hear, like every now and then, just like these certain phrases, you know, everyone's got a purpose in life and, you know, everything happens for a reason. And I started to question things because when I was at school, I grew up in a Catholic school, right? And nothing against religion or Catholicism at all. It's just, I remember in Mass, I would hear that, you know, we find our purpose through the Bible. Our meaning of our life will achieve like through like contributing in God's word or whatever. Like just hearing that, I don't know, like personally didn't make sense to me. And yeah, I started questioning myself, asking what was, you know, the meaning of my life. And how do you answer that at 12 years old? It's, yeah, a bit tough.
Yeah, pretty deep question to ask yourself.
Yeah, it sort of I don't know, like, cause some, like, confusion. So I asked myself a second question. Well, if I was, you know, gone and dead, would anything actually change? But when you're alive, it's another question that's hard to answer. So I asked myself, you know, if, well, purpose is about contributing to others, do I actually, you know, add any value to society? And that's, yeah, when I had my answer, I was 12. I lived at home with my parents. I didn't have a job. I mean, what was I really doing? I was just taking up space, so to speak, right? And that hurt me when I had that answer, because then I realized if I, you know, was gone and dead, nothing would actually change or be any different. There'd just be more space for someone else. And so what did that really mean? I don't really have a purpose in life or any reason to be here. Yeah, I labeled myself as worthless, and that stung when I came to that conclusion, because, how do I say it? Nothing else made sense. Those were the only answers that I thought that, you know, were true. And so I really carried that with me. Even though I dwelled on those questions for hours trying to change it, it just didn't really work. I couldn't come up with any other answer.
That's heartbreaking to hear you say that.
Yeah, it sort of started for me and went down a pretty dark road after that. I mean, at 13, at the end of that school year, right, it's like the Christmas holidays, I dabbled in with drugs. I got involved in that world and, you know, eventually started dealing as well. You know, how does a 13-year-old afford, that stuff? It's, yeah, there's only one way. And so, I got involved in that 4 months into my, you know, drug addiction and all that stuff. And it's now, you know, year eight. And there was this girl, and this was different. This was really different. Yeah, she meant a lot to me, and she became my girlfriend. And this was different, because I never had any, like, I never really felt connected to a female before. Like I said, I never felt connected to my parents. And this was kind of cool. I was, spending time with her. She was innocent. She was beautiful. She was, yeah, everything I wanted at the time. Though, like I said, she was innocent. How could I tell her about any of the drugs? And if I told her about how I was feeling, I mean, I already wasn't telling anyone. No one in my life at the time really spoke about these things. No one really ever addressed it. If someone was upset, you know, they just gave them their space. They just didn't. They no one spoke about it. And they themselves wouldn't talk about their feelings. It's uncomfortable. Everyone wanted to put on a smile for everyone else, and so I did the same. But why was I going to now tell my girlfriend? You know, the last thing I want to do is burden her and have her not like me or whatever. And so, yeah, I kept to myself for a while. And a little bit into our relationship, she found out that at a local house party, some of my mates at school had started smoking pot and that I had joined them that night. And yeah, she didn't like that. She gave me two options. Matt, take me or take the drugs. Like, I can't have both in my life. It's toxic. That was a pretty hard situation, I suppose. Hard question to, ultimatum, I suppose, to be given. And I, to her face, I told her I didn't want the drugs and I wanted to stay with her. But at the back of my mind was a whole different story going on. I mean, the reason I got into the drugs, reason for it all, I thought it, and I firmly believed this was my fix. I felt like I'd have a bumper and I'd feel invincible, or I'd have a cone or a joint or whatever. And I felt like I was quote unquote free. I didn't feel like I was trapped inside my own mind with all these thoughts and these feelings that, you know, really dragged me down. She's only been in my life for 4 months. What would she know? Does she even know what I'm thinking and feeling?
Well, if you weren't talking to her, then no.
That's very fair. That's very fair. But she, as I was in my own head with all these thoughts, I realized how angry I was. And, the universe works in mysterious ways. As I'm like, you know, in that angry state, I get a message from her just saying like, hey, Matt, how you going? Like, she wasn't angry at me or anything like that. And so, all that's going through my mind is like, I have all these stories, but she doesn't feel that way. Yeah, shit, maybe she's right. Maybe it is messing with me. And so I got out of dealing as a stepping stone in the right direction, so I thought. And yeah, it took me 3 months after that to give up coke. And that was rough because I'd stopped the one thing that I thought was my escape and my fix. But I needed other things to know to mask these emotions. And so I started, you know, other habits like DJing. I started playing the guitar. And hell, I started going to the gym. Because, you know, coming off coke, I was extremely skinny. My family were concerned about me too. Always saying, Matt, eat, 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 and all that stuff. And yeah, I was insecure about my body. Though, because I was insecure about my body and wanted to build it up, that being the reason I was going to the gym, my intention and the context going into the gym and all that stuff was all based around insecurities. And so when I was now, you know, at school, so this is like year 9, people started to notice my results. And even people in the older grades. And they're all like, you know, pumping up my tires, so to speak. They're always saying like, Matt, look, you're getting bigger. You're packing on the beef, all this stuff. Look at you and all that stuff. And they were, yeah, it became this thing where like, you know, Matt was the gym guy. And, you know, I became serious about it. I really took on that identity because I was insecure and always seeking after connection. And I felt like I achieved it by everyone giving me compliments, by, you know, saying how big I was and how ripped I was and all that stuff. That at the end of that year, I had been going gym now for what, 8 months, give or take. This is at the year 9 camp. And one of my mates came to me and said, hey, Matt, like, we're on the beach. And like, yeah, server's talking shit about you. I'm like, what are you saying? He said, oh, you're on steroids and whatnot. And I was like, okay, that's funny. Like, two teachers here, they're talking about me like that. And then my mate asked me, all right, so Matt, are you on gear? Are you on steroids? Have you been touching that stuff? And I was like, maybe. I sort of played this game where it was, you know, was I on steroids? I didn't want people to know whether I was or wasn't. And, you know, people kept asking me.
Why not?
Because it fed my ego.
Why did you not just say no?
If I said no, how do I say it? It doesn't create any curiosity or suspicion, if that makes sense. Like, this is my thinking at the time. Being someone who's viewed as this, like, a buff guy, to say, are you on steroids, is the ultimate compliment, so I thought. And so that just fed my ego, and it gave me more and more compliments, so to speak. And yeah, I really took that on board. And you know, at the end of that year, I was like, look, I've got a 6-week break. I want to come back to school and no one noticing me. I drastically increased my diet. And coming back to school, it was exactly that. Like, I'd put on all this weight. Hell, in 8 months, I put on 30 kilos. In 4 months, I dropped 20 of it just for this one photo. Like, at the beginning of that bulk or whatever, I had this vision.
Sorry, what was the photo for?
I wanted this photo just to put on my Facebook as my profile photo. I wanted to prove to the world that I was this muscular guy. Now, I don't share all this as a way to show off or anything like that. There's a big mm-hmm. message under this. I wanted the world to view me in a certain way. And look, at the very beginning of 2016, I had this photo. I posted it and everyone believed me. Everyone. You know, all the freaking likes, the comments, the friend requests, girls inboxing me, all that stuff. You know, it was all coming in. Everyone believed Matt's got it all sorted. He's confident, like, he's ripped, he's huge, all this stuff. That's what they see. But inside, all the pain, depression, anxiety that I'd felt, that hadn't gone away. Those insecurities were only magnified now within me. That pain I'd been experiencing brought me to now, a week after that photo was taken, when the world believes Matt's the, you know, best or the epitome of whatever. I then decided to go take my own life on January 9th, 2016.
Did the gym just become another addiction for you?
Yeah, it's exactly what it was. I became addicted to the compliments and the everyone just inflating my ego. That's all it was about. And I mean, I'm not trying to justify it, but like, I thought that was my answer. Just like I thought the drugs were.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying gym's bad, exercising bad. God, no. Exercising is a great thing. It was just my intentions behind it and why I was doing it, which is what I would say, in a way, enhanced the depression. I was seeking connections the entire time. Yeah, it took me to that place where at around 11 o'clock at night, this is a day also before I was supposed to go on a family holiday, I just went and jumped to try to end my own life. And after thinking about it for 4 years, thinking I'd finally done the one thing that I was meant to do, because I believed I was a waste of space for so long, to wake up 2 weeks later in a hospital bed, knowing that mentally and emotionally you're no different, but physically you're in a situation where it's so much worse, that gutted me. To know that, you know, or to believe at least, that beforehand, you know, that I was worthless and all this stuff, and all that I wanted to do was end my own life, and I couldn't even do that right. If I was worthless beforehand, how pathetic am I now? I mean, I could not get those words out of my head day in, day out, just thinking that. Yeah, a lot of tears came out in hospital. I wasn't in a good place at all.
Sorry to interrupt here, just to take a step back. So did you plan to do this, or was it a spur of the moment on that night that you just had enough?
I had planned exactly how I was going to do it, where I was going to do it, the time of day, all of that. It's like I wrote it's like I prepared a script for this freaking thing. And I like dead set visualize this scene or whatever, just this like idea in my mind of how I was going to go about it day in, day out for a year. I'd known exactly how I was going to go about it. It's funny because I'm actually afraid of heights, but I figured that if it's all going to come to an end, like, what does it really matter? Who gives a shit if I'm scared of heights? Like, it's going to be over.
So you climbed onto a building and jumped off. How high was the building?
Like 35 meters.
And you survived it. 35 meters. Wow.
Yeah. When I say I planned this, I mean I planned the highest point, like, and to land on concrete too. I mean, like, yeah, it was a pretty sight.
You were meant to survive.
Yeah, I had many doctors and people were just telling me, Matt, you're lucky to be alive. You're lucky to be alive. And I remember asking my parents, like, how did I survive and why am I still here? And they said, Matt, you're probably blessed that you went to the gym so much, that, you know, the muscles and strength that you had, that probably what, like, you know, made you pull through. To hear that kind of broke my heart at the same time, as much as I didn't want to be there, but also because all my muscles had melted. I was now the skinniest I'd ever been. And I was also in a wheelchair. I couldn't function or feel half my body. I had a spinal cord injury, had a brain injury, all this stuff. And that, oh man. And being in hospital, it bothered me because everyone wanted to know the exact same question. Like, everyone in the spinal ward, you know, everyone just spoke about, you know, what happened to you? What happened to you? And me being 16, like, you're so young, why do you have a spinal cord injury? And I was so ashamed that even when, you know, people came to visit me, they would ask me, and even people in public, complete strangers, you know, why are you in the wheelchair? What happened? Like, are you okay? And all that stuff. I never said the truth. Couldn't never say the truth. I always said, you know, I had an accident. I mean, the most I would ever say was I had a fall. And that was it. I was so embarrassed because I had failed.
So how did you cope at that stage? And you're in the hospital with a spinal cord injury. You've still got the same mental health issues that you had prior to that, plus your physical conditions now on top of that. How did you cope with that? What did you do to kind of help yourself get through that?
When you're in that state, you don't even want to become better. You just, in a way, just simmer in it all. And you just reaffirm those beliefs that you have and the way you feel. You almost validate reasons why to be depressed. It, in a way, was a self-fulfilling prophecy. But the one thing that hospital forced me to do was feel my emotions. Because for 4 years, I'd done the exact opposite of that. I'd done my best to hide it, put on a smile for everyone, and, you know, still like be the man, so to speak, whether it was through like basketball, through the gym, and like, well, in my own space, like drugs, and then eventually my mates got into it, you know, doing it around them. The whole time I was just escaping my emotions because I was so uncomfortable and afraid to feel how I was truly feeling. I didn't want to talk to anyone, but hospital forced me in a place where I had to feel my emotions. And they were the most painful tears I'd ever had. And, you know, being on 24-hour watch, and I was in bed for 2 months. I couldn't really do anything. They didn't really let me out of the bed. And when they did, I wasn't allowed a chair that I could push. Someone else had to push me because of my mental state. But it was 3.5 months, give or take, nearly 4 months into my hospital stay, where I was with my mum. Now, we went to Penrith to get like a couple piercings. I used to have 2 piercings on my eyebrow. I recently took them out. Like, I don't know about you, Jess, if you got any like piercings or tattoos or anything, but when you get them done, it's, yeah, like there's this feeling of like, you know, like check me out and all that stuff, you know, like you feel good about yourself. And so I felt a little bit lighter. And so on the train ride back to the hospital, halfway through this trip, this guy comes on. I'd never met him before. Never met him. This real bogan sort of character. He has no filter. Just, he comes on the train, steps on, and before he even sits down, he sees me. He's like, "The fuck did you do to yourself? Jesus Christ." He like looks me up and down. And I don't know what it was, but I mean, the only thing that makes sense to me was, you know, the mixture of the how light I was feeling because I got my piercings and just how, you know, how abrupt and how blunt he was. I just sort of said it. I said, "Look, I attempted suicide." he starts laughing at me. Like in
laughing at you.
Yeah. That was pretty fucking stupid. Look at you now.
Oh no.
You just
what was your response to that?
What do you say to that? I mean, I never come across anyone that like sort of came to me like that. Like, while I'd always lied and said, "Oh, I had a fall" or "I had an accident" to people, some people that were close to me, like, they obviously knew. They knew the truth. I did my absolute best to hide my depression, but I took no effort in hiding my attempt. And they knew. And so everyone treated me like I was this precious thing that always had to be said yes to. And I understand why. No one saw it coming. It was a very emotional time for not only them, but me as well. And right. So like, no one knew how to address the situation. So everyone was like, you know, just treating me nicely and all that stuff. This is the first guy that was so blunt. He just spoke his mind.
Yeah.
And I really believe that's exactly what I needed. Because the next morning, I woke up with this sense of, you know, lightness. And I can't quite explain it. But I never felt that as long as I could remember. And going to my, you know, social worker and sharing with her, like, what happened, how that guy on the train made me feel. Yeah, it was strange. Because I never gone to my social worker. She was always chasing after me. And she said, "Matt, I think that's a sign." And back in my mind, I sort of knew where she was going with that. And I just said, "What are you talking about?" And she said, "Matt, this was the first time in what, 4 months, you told someone the truth. You said you attempted suicide." And yeah, like, he gave that weird reaction, but you woke up feeling lighter. I don't know, Matt. What if you were to open up to the people close to you in life? could you potentially strengthen the relationship you already have with them? And, you know, she knew I wasn't being real with those around me. And hearing that pissed me off. I didn't want to talk after hearing that. I just, I mean, I never liked talking. But that was such a, like, yeah, that just sort of came out. I didn't mean for that to happen. But, you know, when my girlfriend came to visit me that afternoon, my social worker's words, like, just stuck in my head that entire day. And I was real with her. She asked, how are you, Matt? And I told her the truth. Yeah, I told her, I'm not doing that well.
And what was her response to that?
Yeah, it was, I mean, she was like, how do I say it? I don't know if the word, I'm not sure if it's the right word, overwhelmed, but see it like this. This is the first time really that like I was real with her. And she had never seen this side of me that was, you know, being authentic. And she said, Matt, I mean, she's in tears and so am I, but she said, Matt, yeah, like, I've never loved you more. I've never felt closer to you. Yeah, hearing that, like, really, to this day, it honestly just, it still affects me to this day because of, for so long, just believing that I was so worthless, that I shouldn't be here anymore. And to go and attempt suicide, fail, and be left, you know, in a wheelchair, not be able to feel or function half my body, held my bladder, bowel, and like a sexual function, all that stuff at the time, like just was completely not working. To hear her say that, it just confused the hell out of me. Because, you know, I didn't have the muscles anymore. Why would she love me? Why would she feel close to me? Why would she want to be with me? Why was she still there in hospital? And, you know, she came to visit me so often. And, yeah, man, it just confused the hell out of me. But we became closer as a result. And, you know, she, yeah, started being more real with me. And so I started talking to some of my friends and even my parents. Those two people I felt so disconnected with. And things started to shift because I now had a, you know, supportive network around me. People valued me. And that's something I never believed.
But do you think they had always valued you, but you just didn't realize it at the time? And you were now starting to realize how much they actually did care about you?
Yeah. Yeah. I really did start to see that. And even it was interesting talking to some of my mates. Look, not all of them, you know, wanted to deal with it. And some of them felt uncomfortable or even overwhelmed by it. They didn't know how to deal with it, right? Mm-hmm. So some of them drifted. But those who I really valued, you know, they stuck around. And we became so close. And that changed a lot for me. But it was the end of that year that my social worker, the same one, asked me to come back to the hospital for a meeting, and she wanted to share an opportunity with me. Yeah, she said, Matt, we have this program at the hospital if you're open for it. You would share your story to about 30 or so young people at a time. And yeah, you know, Matt, remember that guy on the train? Remember what that did for you? What if you could help others help you as well? And it was, how do I say it? Like this calling in a way, because it's like I didn't even think before I spoke. I just said yes without even just, I didn't put any thought to it. Mm-hmm. You know, walking out of that room, I was like, what did I sign up for? But in March was the first time I actually shared my story. And I was nervous is one word, but I mean, just shaking afterwards, thinking, what are they all thinking of me? Why did I do this? And what... Yeah, and the first time I'd share my story made things so freaking real for me that I...
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd never done anything quite like it in public too. But to have these young people come up to me afterwards and thank me, shake my hand and say, Matt, you inspired me. Matt, like, thank you. Like, some of them said they want to help their friends more as a result. To have this voice in your head for 5 years saying... Matt, you're worthless. Matt, you shouldn't be here anymore and all this other stuff. So now hear those words just brought tears to my eyes. And I held it back when I was in the room. But when I was by myself, I couldn't help but just bawl my eyes out. And to this day, it holds a special place in my heart, because if I hadn't said yes to that opportunity, I do not know where I'd be. And it was, as I'm there, like in tears, like I'm there at the bus stop waiting to go back home, I got a call from the manager of the program, and she said, "Matt, that teacher that was there, you know, supervising the kids, she asked to bring you next week to her parents' like information evening."
Oh wow!
it was like this like voice that spoke for me. Like I didn't even think about it. I just said yes, and that week after, my parents drove me to that school, and you know, going from 30 people in a little room to now about 300 people in a hall, parents, students, staff, and the speaker before me had PowerPoints, videos, photos, and all this stuff, handouts even. And I'm like, "What are you talking about?" And I'm brought up as the last speaker of the night, but I've got nothing but the mic. I'm just like comparing myself, but the same thing happened, where I had young people like, you know, lining up to like ask me questions, but not only share how it inspired them, but also ask how they can support themselves, but also their friends as well, more and more. Just afterwards, that feeling came back. And when I was in the car on the way back home, my dad had asked me, "Matt, do you see yourself taking this somewhere?" And it took a while for me to answer, but I said, "Yeah," because I'd realized that night I'd become the person that I needed when I was 12. Had I not shared my story and I suppose been real about these things that no one's speaking about, I wouldn't have had those young people come up to me. But not only that,
mm-hmm.
if I had had that when I was 12, what would that have done for me? Would I have then, you know, approached that speaker or approached someone else? Would I have a model to go off? And don't get me wrong, I'm still depressed at this stage. But I kept at that program. And then I finished school that year. And I was so blessed to meet someone. And he mentored me. And he helped me, like, you know, the whole process of going into schools myself, then going into the corporate world, then conferences, universities, all that stuff. And not just share my story, but now also facilitating workshops where it's all based around, you know, how people can become more resilient, how we can bounce back when times get rough, how we can become more mentally strong and overcome our fears. When I started matching what I loved with what I did every day, my life started to transform completely. I started, you know, looking forward to waking up in the day rather than dreading it and saying, "Why the hell am I still here?" I started to have purpose. And those three questions I had: what's the meaning of my life? My mission's to inform, inspire, and influence millions of mindsets for them to, you know, create profound change in their lives. If I was gone and dead, would anything change or be different? Hell, I've spoken to over 12,000 high school students alone. So, do I add any value to society? Hell freaking yes. I'm a mental fitness facilitator. And to be able to say that's really freaking cool now.
I love hearing that. What a transformation. Incredible.
But if only I'd known back then what I know now, if I was to go into specifics, the people I was surrounding myself with, how big of an influence they really had on my life. I mean, why I got into drugs wasn't purely my choice. I didn't think, "Oh, this will be an escape. This will work." No, I had friends that influenced me that weren't from school. Initially, that's the right reason I got into it. But then it was my girlfriend at the time that got me out of it. Then it was, you know, the guy on the train, how that made me feel. The social worker, what she taught me. But then the friends, the people that I'm close with now, and the mentors I have in my life, surrounding myself with people that not only support me, that bring me up, people I value, people that are important to me. I started to feel more of how I wanted to feel. But then also matching what I loved with what I did every day. That was the secret. I mean, just to actually looking forward to the day. And yeah, being able to have some purpose in life. That's where my true happiness came from.
So when you go and you're speaking at schools now, I'll use schools as an example, what are some of the messages you're trying to get across to the kids that you think are helping them?
That first one of being aware of who you're surrounding yourself with, that plays such a big role. To be able to be around people that value you as much as you value them is so important. Because when we have that, we have some connection that's meaningful. It's not empty. And I'm surrounding myself with people because I think they're cool, or because they get a lot of girls, or because they do a lot of drugs or whatever. God, like, I did that for years. I thought it was, you know, the answer, but it was empty because I wanted to feel happier. Deep down, that's really what I wanted to feel, happier, you know, more grateful, hell, more excited in my life. But the people I was surrounding myself with, okay, they feel the need for excitement, but the things that they would do and the way they would treat me as well, they made me feel belittled. Hell, I felt frustrated when I was with them as well. Like, I didn't agree with everything that they did. Some of them wanted to get in fights and all that stuff. I'm like, what are you doing? But why was I hanging around them if I didn't want to feel that? It made no sense. Then another key message that I'm really all about is our personal battery. You know, like our phones, if you charge your phone overnight, you wake up, it's 100%. Over the night, we sleep, we wake up, our battery's charged. And going about our day, we tend to use our battery, use our energy. We do things, we work, we study, we, you know, cook, we shop, whatever we do, right? Things that, you know, take our energy away. Though, like our phones, we can recharge them throughout the day as well. There are things that fill up our cup. There are things that we do that give us energy, that excite us. Things that, you know, make us happier, feel lighter. I mean, for me, like, you saw me earlier on, like, I was playing this guitar here. I was, that's one thing. Cold showers is another one. I love meditation. I love going to the gym. As much as I use my energy, I also feel great as a result. And it's, you know, being aware of these things is so key, because now we have things that we can go to, you know, when we're not feeling that great. But the first step is always a supportive network. When we're in the midst of depression, it's so hard to see that people actually value us, because in that moment, we don't really value ourselves. And so how can we see that? Well, why don't we flip the question on its head? Rather than asking who you can go to, why not the first question you ask is, who do you support? By asking who you support, we start to think outside of us, oh, well, you know, I support, you know, my friends, my neighbors, my parents, my siblings. I guarantee you, everyone's going to have people that they support. But what if we flipped it on its head now? Would they support you? Because I'll say more times than not, those people would be there for you. And if we're looking to support someone else, the first thing we can do is listen. It's the best thing we can do. You need to listen without judgment. And just to be there for them allows them to feel validated. That it's not weird. That not that they shouldn't be feeling it, but that it's okay to be feeling their emotions. Because that's what's real for them. If someone feels that they don't have a voice, they have no one to go to, and that life's meaningless, to have someone that's willing to be there for them, that's going to mean the world. Yeah, there's so much under this that we could talk about.
I'm sitting here forgetting that I'm actually interviewing you because I'm so engrossed in what you're saying. And I've heard your story multiple times. To keep going with that point, if someone listening knows someone who is struggling at the moment, which a lot of people are obviously at the moment, what do you think they can do? What are some steps they can take to help that person?
The most important step is, like, and this goes without saying, you need to be genuinely interested in wanting to support that person. Now, I say this because authenticity is the biggest, or just being authentic is the biggest thing when it comes to mental health, when it comes to addressing these things. If we're able to firstly be genuinely interested and we want to support that person. Secondly, when something's up, we need to speak up. Not only within ourselves, but also someone else. If we notice someone is distancing themselves from everyone, there's sudden change in behavior, they're not acting like themselves, or they really look down like one day, approach them in a private matter and ask them, how are you going? Like how are you really going? Are you okay? I'd like to hear you out. I want you to know I'm here for you. That is the one way we can start this conversation. You know, in Australia, that movement, Are You Okay? Personally, I love it. It's such an important movement because that's the first step most people aren't taking, addressing the issue, actually checking in with people. Okay, now you've started the conversation. Now, they might not be open to talking to you. You know, not everyone's going to feel comfortable talking and opening up. That's okay too. I need you to know that it's never your responsibility of how someone else is feeling. But what you can do is encourage other supports, whether it be a friendly one, you know, a more personal one, whether it be parents, friends, neighbors, family, it's anyone close, partners, whatever. But then also encouraging professional supports. In Australia, we're blessed. We have many, not only like psychologists, social workers, but many mental health platforms we can go to. There are many numbers we can call up, even overseas. These are all available. If you don't want to see someone in person, we can call up hotlines. And let's say you're not comfortable speaking like through the phone. There's even chat services online for free that you can access counselors. There's many things out there that we can't access. And that point I brought up earlier on, this goes without saying, listening. But not just physically being there, because that's one thing. You know, not being on your phone, be physically listening to them. How about mentally listening? Actually putting your attention and focus on what they're saying. Doing your best to understand, which then leads into emotionally listening. Showing empathy, really trying to put yourself in their shoes, understanding why they're feeling the way they're feeling. Not necessarily being caught up in it, but just trying to understand. Because by understanding how they're feeling, you're validating their emotions. You're validating their situation and you're helping them feel supported.
What is this like for you to, obviously that time of your life was very difficult for you, and for you to be out there now speaking about it over and over again to help other people, what is that like for you to keep reliving that time of your life?
Every time I share it, it feels, yeah. Sometimes it hits me more than others. Sometimes it's interesting. And the one thing I don't want to do is perform the story. It's never what I want to do. I want it to always be authentic. And there are moments throughout the story that really hit me at times. And it's interesting. But also, I believe sharing my story over and over again has helped me with it all. So I didn't talk for so long. And at the same time, it did also at times be a, I suppose, somewhat of a negative. When I say that, I mean people were now validating me based on my story.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's because of my story that I'm now good enough, sort of thing. It's like, oh my God, you're so inspiring. Look at the journey you've been through. And there's nothing wrong with saying that stuff. It's just when I got caught up in it all. Because when I was, you know, 17, it was hard, I suppose, hard not to. Because that was all I was really doing at the time. But now that I've expanded what I'm doing, sharing my story, I understand, is of value. I'm going to continue doing it. But I'm also going to be doing these workshops, because now it's not about my story. It's also about what value other people can, you know, get out of it, how they can bounce back. That's what's important to me. Because by being the person that I needed when I was 12, I'm not just sharing my story. more so giving them the tools and the strategies and the inner tools that they can access. We all have, by the way, we all have them, which is funny enough. It's just sometimes we need to be guided on how to use them.
How old are you now?
I'm 22.
And if someone comes up to you now who doesn't know who you are, not at a workshop, a random person, and asks you, why are you in a wheelchair? What would your response now be? Back then you said you were lying. What would you do now?
I'll say it how it is. I attempted suicide. Some people think I'm lying. Some people think I'm, I don't know. Some people like have some weird reactions. I strangers ask me all the time. It's I don't find it offensive. yeah. Like I don't find it offensive. I find it it comes from a place of curiosity. We all have that. And there's nothing wrong with being curious. I personally believe. And I understand not everyone's going to take that question the exact same way as me. Especially people who are in similar situations who have attempted suicide. That can be confronting and overwhelming.
And what's your mental health like now?
Yeah, it's gone so much better. I'm in a place where I would say I wouldn't change anything in my life.
Oh, that's great.
Not even the wheelchair. Look, I was told I'll never walk again. I was told it's impossible to walk again. Matt, your spinal cord is severed. There's no way you've got nerve signals going through your spinal cord. It's funny because every day I do sit the stands with my trainers. Hell, today I was in the gym and I got on the bike so I could continuously progress my rehab. And I can pedal that bike without using my hands.
Oh, wow.
I've had other stuff come back as well. I honestly believe I'm truly blessed. Now, this is part of bouncing back. It's not just doing the work. That's the first step. But then to have the persistence to keep at it, even though, you know, reality might be showing me something else. But that third part, the belief that I know for a fact that I will walk again is what keeps me going. That's really, I believe, the most powerful part of those three. But you need all three of them. And that's not just to do with, you know, walking again for me. That's to do with anyone else who's doing it rough. If we have a goal, believing we can do it, persisting through, like, you know, no matter how tough it could be, and then doing the work, you're guaranteed to get there. I coach basketball to kids, and I learn so much from these 7 and 8 year olds. It's amazing. I honestly love it. They're 7 and 8 years old, right? And I remember this one time, I was there early. And I like to get there early just so I can shoot some hoops and practice myself. One of my goals is to actually compete in the wheelchair basketball Olympics. And I know I'll get there. I just got to keep practicing, got to keep working on it. Though, as I was there early, there were these few kids that were there early as well. Now, two of them, I see them regularly. One of them I coach regularly too. Though there was a girl there as well, a young girl that was friends with them. And they all went to the movies earlier on that day, but they all came there early because they're like, we don't need to go back home, sort of thing. We'll just wait out the half an hour. And they were, sitting there, and I got them a ball, and I was like, hey, you guys want to start shooting? And so the two guys, I'll say guys, that they were 7 years old, they had, they were shooting hoops, but the hoops were all the way up, like just as high as they are when they're in the NBA. Like they weren't lowered, and you know they could get some of the buckets in. But the little girl, like, she sort of shied away. And I got her a ball. Oh, I actually gave her my ball. And I was like, hey, look. Oh, her name was Amelia. I was like, Amelia, do you want to take a shot? And she's like, I can't reach the rim. It's too high. And I said, have you done it before? She's like, no, but look at it. I was like, you never know unless you try. And she's like, okay. So she tried a few times. After, two or three shots, she's already doubting herself. She's like, it's too high. I can't do this. This is too hard. All this stuff, right? And genuinely, some of her shots were so close. And I was like, Amelia, if you a little more to the right, a little more to the left, if you just had a little more distance, you're so close. And she kept going. And, you know, as she's shooting, she kept like saying out loud, I can't do this. I can't do this. And I don't know what, 20, 30 shots later, she gets one in. And her eyes, her face just lit up. And I can just see it right now. It makes me smile because her reaction was just priceless. Oh my God. I made it. I made it. Did you see that? And, oh, man, it was so wholesome. And I, yeah, Amelia taught me that day as well and just reminded me, if we have a goal, no matter the doubts that come up, because they're going to come up, right? It's human. But if we persist through them and just continuously work at it, be patient and persist through, we will achieve the goals. And yeah, oh man. Yeah, I have so many stories like that from basketball, but anyways.
So how have you changed your mindset around the gym? Going from being that, having it to be, you know, look a certain way, basically, how you were, why you were going originally, to now being more of functional goals, I'm presuming, to build up your strength and function to be able to hopefully walk again one day. How have you changed that mindset? Because when you said before that one of the things you enjoy doing is going to the gym, I automatically thought, oh, but that was like a triggering thing for you before. How have you changed that?
So after my injury, it took me, I don't know, 9-10 months before I was going back to the gym. But I was going there like once a week, once every 2 weeks. And that was purely based on how I was looking. I was so insecure about how I looked. And though the more I started sharing my story, the more I realized how gym was such a bad thing before my injury. Because I used to view it as such a good thing. But though when I realized it was bad, I took a step back. And I was like, wait a minute, what am I doing? And, you know, I started setting strength goals. And, you know, I was working at them. But now, why do I go to the gym? I go to the gym purely based on my mindset. I use it as an opportunity to become more mentally strong. You know, those times where I feel like I'm you know, fatiguing and all this stuff, like saying to myself, I've got more in me. I've got more in me. Like, there's so much more I can do right now. And being able to push through that fatigue, I believe I level up each and every time. It's all a mental game for me now, going to the gym. And my perspective on it has changed completely. And look, like with all that consistency comes the muscles back. Yeah, sure. But because my intention is now all about the mindset and what it's delivering me, my focus is not on the muscles anymore. I have such a different mindset around it all. And when I see people, they could be muscular, they could have the top off and all that stuff and whatever. But I see people now for who they are. What's behind that? Who are you? I want to see you for you. Because now what I'm really about is having that real conversation. I don't give a shit what someone presents as. I give a shit about who someone is. And by shifting my intention, I've shifted my focus.
I could talk to you all day. I'm not going to. I'm not going to hold you up all day. Is there anything else you wanted to say, talk about before we wrap up?
I want everyone to know that who they authentically are is not only enough, but it's who they were meant to be. We weren't supposed to hide and mask not only how we're feeling, but what we want to do, the decisions we want to make, the people we really want to surround ourselves with. Start listening to that inner voice. That voice that comes from your heart, because that's your true self. So often we suppress it, we're taught to. Hell, growing up, we're always taught that, you know, think before you speak. Grow up. Don't say those things. And sometimes we do say the wrong things, but that voice that comes from our hearts, it's there for a reason. It's you at your best self.
I will pop all of your details for how people can find you in the show notes for this episode, but do you want to just quickly tell everybody how they can connect with you?
Yeah, for sure. My website is probably the easiest way to contact me, which is www.mattcaruana.com. So that's MATTCARUANA.com. My Instagram is MattShares. I'm on there more than any other platform of social media, and my Facebook and LinkedIn are Matthew Caruana.
Now, I do have one final question that I ask everyone at the end of their interviews, and it may be what you just said before, but we'll see. So if you could go back in time and give your younger self one piece of advice, what would it be?
follow your heart. When I was 12, there was all these emotions going on inside of me. Our emotions come up for a reason, and I felt like I wasn't allowed to feel them. But if I listened to my heart, I would have allowed myself the time to experience it. And if I was listening to my heart as well, not only would I be experiencing my emotions, but I'd be expressing them as well. Suppressing was the one thing that, God knows where I'd be if I had done that when I was younger. But I know I am the person that I need to be now. Because if it wasn't for my journey, I wouldn't be where I am. Though listening to my heart would be the one bit of advice I would give. Just be real. Because that's your true voice.
Thank you so much for sharing your story with us all today. Matt, it's been fantastic to hear that you're doing so well now and that you're helping so many people along the way. So thank you so much for just being you and for sharing your story and, helping everyone.
I truly appreciate this opportunity, Jess. I can't bring to words how much this actually means to me, because it's conversations like this that truly fulfill me and reaffirm that my purpose is alive. And not only is mine, but also everyone else's.
If this episode brought up any issues for you, please contact Lifeline on 131114 or refer to the show notes for other organisations that can help you. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Inspirational Tales. If you're enjoying the podcast, I'd love it if you could please share it with your family and friends so that we can inspire more people. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts or iTunes, please don't forget to leave us a rating or a review, and make sure that you have subscribed or followed the podcast on whichever platform that you are listening to it on so that you can stay up to date as new episodes are released. Thanks again, and I look forward to you joining me for the next episode of Inspirational Tales.